There's just so many reasons to listen to WRT. I should remind you, you've been listening to the Green Morning Radio right here on WORT, 89.9 FM here in Madison, Wisconsin, WRTFM.org. And yeah, my name's Brian. It's been a pleasure. I'll see you all next week.
Darfur region are dying of thirst. Many of the thousands who walked there from the Zamzam refugee camp were completing the 70-kilometre journey in a state of severe dehydration. There's also concern about the hundreds of thousands displaced following the paramilitary RSF's capture of the camp. Marian Ramstein is the project coordinator with MSF in North Darfur.
The situation is horrific. We estimate that in the space of a couple of days, 40,000 people arrived. With nothing, just the clothes they are wearing with them, and they arrive with nothing but the image of the terrific attack they witnessed in Zamzam. All of them witnessed the attack.
President Trump has suggested Harvard should lose its tax-exempt status after the world's most richly endowed university rejected what it described as government control and ideological monitoring. Mr. Trump said tax exemption, one of the key ways U.S. universities raise funds, should be reserved for those that serve the public interest. Nomia Iqbal is our North America correspondent.
The Trump administration has accused Harvard of failing to live up to conditions that it says justify federal investment. In a letter to the university, the administration's demands included reporting students seen as hostile to American values, in particular those accused of anti-Semitism, and also making changes to hiring and admissions. The university has rejected this, saying it would mean ceding huge control to the government and compromising its independence. Critics have accused President Trump of authoritarian tactics in trying to reshape university education in the US.
Jordan's intelligence agency says it's arrested 16 people suspected of plotting attacks inside the country involving rockets and drones. A security source said the suspects were linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the largest opposition group in Jordan and had received training and finance in Lebanon. Sebastian Usher reports.
The Jordanian intelligence agency says the plot was aimed at sowing what it calls chaos and sabotage. It says the plans involve manufacturing rockets and drones, as well as recruiting and training operatives both inside Jordan and abroad. The authorities have said that at least one rocket was ready to be launched, and they've already made a link to the powerful Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan, which officials have previously accused of instigating pro-Hamas protests with the aim of destabilizing the kingdom. Jordan has a large Palestinian population, which has become increasingly angry over the war in Gaza.
The Israeli Prime Minister has visited troops in northern Gaza as Israel's offensive against Hamas continues. A Hamas official has said the group is likely to give its response to a new Israeli ceasefire proposal within the next 48 hours. But a senior Palestinian official who is familiar with the negotiations has told the BBC Hamas has rejected the offer, which demands the group's disarmament without committing to Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. World News from the BBC. Lawyers for the US Department of Justice will appear before a judge on Tuesday to provide an update on the case of a man deported to El Salvador. Last week, the Supreme Court said the government must facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was sent to prison there in spite of a legal order allowing him to remain in the US. President Trump appears to have confirmed that China has pulled out of a contract with the American plane manufacturer Boeing. Beijing is said to have ordered Chinese airlines not to take any more deliveries from the company in response to the swingeing tariffs imposed on Chinese products by Mr. Trump. Our business correspondent Theo Leggett says this will be yet another setback for the company.
This is a company which is still trying to recover from what was a dreadful year last year, in which it suffered a serious safety crisis after a door panel fell off one of its planes in January. It's still trying to convince regulators that it's done enough to reform practices in its factories. And it had a devastating strike at the end of the year where 30,000 plus workers in the Pacific Northwest were not working, so deliveries dried up. So it has been a difficult period.
President did not give any details in a post on social media. A Moscow court has sentenced four Russian journalists to 5.5 years in prison for cooperating with Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption foundation. In a trial behind closed doors, the four were found guilty of participating in what was described as an extremist community. The retrial in New York of the disgraced former Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein has started with jury selection. His 2020 conviction for rape and sexual assault was overturned last year, and the retrial is expected to see several witnesses from the original proceedings testify again. That decision was a setback for the Me Too movement against sexual violence. More than 80 women have alleged various charges against him since his downfall. Weinstein was separately handed a 16-year prison sentence after a California court convicted him of rape and sexual assault. BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Christina Leffering, news and politics editor at Tone Madison. It's been more than a decade since the Isla Vista attack when a 22-year-old man killed 6 people and injured 14 others. He identified as an incel, meaning someone who feels they are unable to attract sexual partners, and is therefore, quote-unquote, involuntarily celibate. He had driven to a sorority house at the UC Santa Barbara campus in order to murder the women inside as revenge. Having failed, he lashed out using firearms, knives, and his vehicles to attack bystanders in Isla Vista. For many, it was the first time they'd heard of the incel movement, which is one part of what has been colloquially called the manosphere. Despite the manosphere's growing influence on gender and politics, my guest today, Muriel Barnes, argues it has been understudied by political scientists. Her paper titled The Manosphere and Politics, published in Comparative Political Science, seeks to correct that issue by examining the manosphere, its subgroups, and when its misogynistic rhetoric could become violent. Muriel Barnes is an assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs, where she researches everyday forms of violence against women, gender, and the relationship between gender and institutions. She is also a core faculty member of UW-Madison's Sexual Violence Research Initiative, an interdisciplinary group designed to investigate the psychological, societal, and policy aspects of sexual violence. Muriel Barnes, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what is the manosphere and what makes it distinct from other men's rights groups and other forms of online misogyny?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in my research and work, we define the manosphere as a group of loosely connected kind of websites, blogs, and forums that all share this belief that men are oppressed in modern day society. and that the reason they are oppressed is because of women, is because of feminism, and is because of gender equality. And so they call this the gynocracy in place of patriarchy. And yeah, they believe that men are actively being harmed in modern society because of the policies and the kind of pervasive focus on women. And it really differs from other men's groups in that other men's groups are often supportive of men's issues, such as like father's rights or homelessness or high rates of depression and suicide in amongst men, but they do it in a way that is not blaming women and blaming feminism for those problems. It's done in a way that says like, there are problems for women and there are also problems for men and we should address both of them. So it's not this kind of blaming kind of fight between different genders anymore. It's like this more collaborative way, whereas the manosphere is not like that. The manosphere is just like women are to blame for these problems. So that's how I would define it.
And how does technology play a role in the manosphere and how it operates?
Technology has played a huge role, actually. So these kinds of anti-feminist, anti-women groups have existed for a long time. They actually come out of the women's liberation movement. And so there was this idea that during women's liberation, they realized that women's gender roles were repressive and restrictive. And then men also realized that men's traditional gender role is also repressive and restrictive, like this idea that you have to be a breadwinner and you have to be stoic and unemotional and logical and your only your only thing is to work all the time. And that went one of two ways. Either it went that kind of like mutually constitutive way where we support feminism, but we also want to focus on men too, or it went the blaming way that I talked about before. And for a long time, the kind of men who were blaming women were kind of isolated, right? They were focused on issues like father's rights, false rape allegations, sex discrimination towards men, but they were kind of isolated. And then all of a sudden in about 2008, when you get kind of web 2.0 and you get, the invention of like blogging and like long form social media, you get this kind of explosion in manosphere sites. And we can see this kind of in the data. And one of the reasons is like technology just made it a lot easier for people to publish what they wanted to. Like anyone can start a blog on WordPress and start writing their own kind of perspective. And it also made these people easier to find. And so before, it was really often really hard to connect with someone who shared your worldview about women and feminism. And all of a sudden, with technology and the internet and these factors, you can just kind of type it into your Google search and you can search, father's rights or false rape allegations, and you get all of these hits pop up. And so then you can start like communicating with these people and it becomes kind of this reinforcement of this worldview. So technology has really played, I think, an important role in kind of the creation of the modern manosphere movement.
So correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe that your research focused on this era of Web 2.0 manosphere activity up until the manosphere kind of migrated into social media. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And I think there's these distinct periods. So we focus on kind of 2008 we collected data all the way through to 2020. But you can kind of see a drop off in manosphere sites and manosphere activity after about 2013, 2014. And it's not because these people don't exist anymore, but it's what you said in that people are migrating. So they're not using blogs anymore because that's a lot of effort to maintain your own blog or your own website. What you have is you have the rise of Twitter, the rise of Parler, the rise of Gab, Discord, Snapchat. And so what we think in the paper, what we hypothesize, which we can't prove, it's going to be the subject of future work, is that these people moved to, social media. They moved to Reddit. They moved to 4chan. And it just was easier to do that and use other people's kind of website infrastructure than maintain your own.
So why did you decide to focus on the Web 2.0 era of the manosphere?
I think that was really the kind of start of the modern manosphere movement. And so it's important to kind of pinpoint, I think, when these ideas were increasing in popularity and what those ideas at that time were. A lot of people have lumped the manosphere in with the alt-right movement and said it's kind of the same thing. But what our research shows is that the manosphere, like this era of the manosphere, actually predated the rise of the alt-right. Like this was happening in 2010, 2012, right? So before, you know, you have right-wing populism increasing, before Donald Trump has announced his, you know, candidacy for the presidency the first time. And I think what is important is like these views existed prior to that. And then as they've gone along, they've kind of been incorporated in some ways into the alt-right. And that's one of the kind of planks of the alt-right is this kind of heavy misogyny, heavy masculinity, heavy patriarchal belief system. And so, I think it's important to know where that came from.
You're listening to A Public Affair on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. We're talking about the manosphere with Mariel Barnes, assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. And we are taking calls, so if you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 608-256-2001. That's 608-256-2001. So let's dig in a little bit into your research. You broke down the manosphere into four main subgroups. Can you talk about what those are and what makes them distinct from each other?
Yeah. So in the paper, we develop a typology of kind of the manosphere because it's a movement that's united by hatred of women, but within it, there are different groups that want different things. And like, just because you hate women and you hate feminism doesn't mean that everyone in the manosphere wants the same thing. And so the two dimensions of the typology are isolation from other men and then isolation from women. And so there are some groups that isolate themselves from other men. So for instance, incels or pickup artists believe that there's this hierarchy of men, that they call it a social sexual hierarchy. And you have like alpha men at the top, then you have beta men. There's a whole bunch of Greek letters, omega, sigma, delta. And they all have like different meanings and they're all different types of men. But essentially, you're kind of competing with each other. And you're competing with each other for like women, or you're competing with each other for money or jobs or success. And so you end up very isolated from other men in that situation because you see them as competition. And it's not, you're not cooperating with them or like interacting with them in a collaborative way. Now, other groups such as like men's rights activists do collaborate with each other because they see themselves kind of as all discriminated against by society and they want to try and change that. And so in order to do that, you need to have some kind of form of collective action. And so that's one form of one layer of the typology. The second one is this interaction with women. And so some groups, for example, Christian men's rights, they want to interact with women because they want to get married. That's how you fulfill like God's mission to you. They believe heavily in complementarianism. So men and women have distinctive roles within the house and outside of the house. But like you need to be married, right? Like that's the prescription. So you need to interact with women. And it doesn't, by interaction, I don't necessarily mean positive interaction, obviously. Likewise, like pickup artists, right? Their whole thing is that in order to be that alpha male, you want to sleep with a whole bunch of women. And so again, you need to interact with women to fulfill your masculine role. Whereas there's also other groups such as like men going their own way. These tend to be older men. From my experience, they've probably been married before, but they view women as bloodsuckers because they're taking alimony. There's often child payments involved as well. And their whole philosophy is you should never get involved with a woman because she will just take advantage of you and you will end up worse off than you were by yourself. So you have to like go your own way, do your own thing, not interact. Incels are also like that. So even though they want to have these kind of sexual relationships with women, a lot of the time they don't know how, or they think they are biologically determined to be alone and isolated from women. And so the outcome is essentially the same as they isolate themselves from both men and women. And so, yeah, depending on how isolated you are, then has implications for other things. But yeah, those are the two kind of main dimensions of our typology and how we kind of want people to think about the manosphere in terms of how we should classify subgroups within it.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about these subgroups and the typology and what that tells us about their relationship with violence or with other kind of actions to fulfill the goals of their particular group?
Yes. So I will say at the outset, it's very hard to tie each manosphere group to a specific type of violence. But we do in the paper hypothesize that we think there are some types of violence that will be more prevalent amongst different subgroups. So you mentioned the Isla Vista shooting at the start of the show, and that man or that boy was an incel. We hypothesize in the paper that when the more isolated you are, both from men and women, the more likely you are to be incredibly nihilistic about the world, and therefore you're more likely to engage in these kinds of mass shootings or very violent public events that are specifically targeting women, because you view women as like essentially non-people, like they're dehumanizing women to a great extent. And so you enact your rage and your anger about your life on them. And this has happened like multiple times. This Isla Vista was not a one-off. It goes all the way, like one of the earliest versions of this was the Polytechnique massacre that happened up in Canada in 1989, I think. It's a man who walked into a classroom and asked all the men to leave and then shot the women. And so we think that, yeah, if you're incredibly isolated, like incels are, you're more likely to commit these public acts of violence. Whereas someone else like a pickup artist is probably, because your desire is to sleep with a whole bunch of women and you have a whole bunch of strategies for getting women to sleep with you, you're probably more likely to be committing violence such as sexual assault or rape. And then for kind of men's rights, they're often into harassment or doxing of women. There was a website that was set up by a man's rights group called Register Her, which was publishing like the names and locations of people who had women who had made false rape allegations, or I should say allegedly made false rape allegations, or they were putting out bounties for photos of prominent feminists so they could dox them publicly. Like I said, it's hard to make these connections because when someone is arrested for sexual assault or prosecuted for sexual assault, these people often don't say, well, I'm a pickup artist, you know, it's okay, and they don't identify that way. But those are kind of the connections that we draw between the different typologies and the violence that we see committed against women.
Yeah, and I mean, you also mentioned the Christian men's rights movement and how because they have this high interaction with women, but also a kind of cohesion among men, that has morphed into a kind of political philosophy or activism. Like, for example, can you talk a little bit about Matt Walsh and how you see that his political activism kind of playing into that typology?
Yeah, so Christian men's rights, because they want to get married and they want to be the head of this household, like, obviously kind of committing any kind of public violence or a massacre against women is the kind of antithesis to that, right? You don't want to get rid of what you need in order to fulfill your masculine kind of identity. And so what we see there is you have this kind of emergence, I think, of concept of neo-masculinity and traditional kind of conservatism. And what they're arguing a lot of the time is this they don't want to get rid of women, but they do want to return to this very traditional, very like men and women segregated, having certain roles, like women have to be in charge of the household, they have to take care of children, they stay at home a lot of the time and don't work, whereas men go out and are breadwinners and are working. And so that's the kind of worldview they're advocating for, and that's the kind of like political idea that they want to impose on people. And I think that's also, I have not done as much work on this, but where you get kind of the trad wife movement coming out of as well. And this idea that, you know, you stay at home and you're taken care of, and in exchange, you do all the domestic labor in your household's life.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT-FM. I'm Christina Leffering, and I'm talking with Mariel Barnes about her research into the manosphere. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 608-256-2001. That's 608-256-2001. So you wrote in this paper that the manosphere has not been adequately studied by political science researchers. Who has done research into this, and why do you think this topic has been overlooked, particularly by political science?
That's a good question. So there's been a lot of research done on the manosphere, particularly in fields like media studies. They do a lot of work on kind of the linguistic use or the use of like language in the manosphere, because there's this whole, each subgroup has their own kind of weird lexicon, let's say. So I said earlier, there's all these different types of men, right? And they all have Greek letters. And that's something that emerges from like the pickup artist and the incel kind of groups. But then like incels have a whole bunch of words that are derogatory towards women, or even derogatory towards other men, right? So, you know, they call very good, supposedly good looking, very muscular, very successful men like a giga chad, or a very like successful kind of stuck up woman, you know, typical beautiful woman would be a giga Stacy. And they get worse, but I won't say any of them on air. And then, so there's this kind of language that each group has. And so media studies has done a lot of studying of that and like looking at language to see where these groups exist online. Because once you know the language, you can, you know, you can see where these groups are kind of hanging out, because the language will like coalesce. There's also been work on the transmission of like ideas through these groups. And so like the alpha male idea really emerged from pickup artistry, but has been adopted by other groups, incels notably, who've then added to it. Or like the idea of being red-pilled, which has spread kind of throughout the manosphere. It's a reference to the Matrix, where they Neo is offered either the blue pill and he goes back to sleep and goes back to his normal life, or he's offered the red pill and he wakes up and finds out about the truth. And so all the Manosphere considers themselves to be red-pilled. They've woken up and realized that women are discriminating and harming men. Media studies has done a lot on this. Psychology has done a lot on this about like why men join these groups, how you can get them to leave these groups as well. I think the reason why political science has not studied this maybe in such detail is, first of all, it was an underground movement. It was kind of hidden. Like, I first got into kind of studying this in 2014, and it was just kind of something that I almost stumbled into. Like, I saw something on one of these groups or something they said one day, and I was like, that's really strange. And then it was just kind of a rabbit hole that went on from there. And then eventually it became this research. So first of all, it was an underground movement for a long time. Unless you were really looking for it, you wouldn't have known that it existed, because it was a marginal and fringe movement for a long time. And then I think there's also this idea that there's been this idea that it's not cohesive, and that, you know, incels are violent and are problematic, but then people don't look at the other groups that exist. For a long time, pickup artists were not seen necessarily as harmful. So the pickup artistry comes out of a book called The Game, which was written by Neil Strauss, that was published, I think, in the mid-2000s. But at the time, it was like a very popular book, and it was marketed as like this revolutionary way of like how men could be more successful with women. And it was kind of like this self-help thing. And so I think political science hasn't seen this as a cohesive movement that is these different groups are linked together. And I think what our research is trying to show is that actually it is cohesive, even if they have different views. They are united under this banner of hating women and hating feminism and hating gender equality. And those views are political views, right? Like, people will often say that gender equality is political. Well, why is being anti-gender equality not a political perspective? It is. And so we need to acknowledge that. And so those are some of the reasons why I think political science has maybe been a little slower on the uptake of studying the Manosphere.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I was thinking about as you were talking about the lingo of particularly incels is that, I mean, just the lingo itself, it's kind of hard to take seriously because it sounds like a bunch of middle school boys, but it is something that is strangely being shared by young men as well. I don't know if there's any kind of insight from that, but that's just how it comes across to me. But
yeah, it's really hard to tell who these people are. That's one problem. But my general sense is that, yes, incels skew younger. Like, they're more likely to be teenagers, more likely to be young men who haven't had a girlfriend before, haven't had any sexual experiences before. And so that's kind of powering their hatred, right? Whereas someone like a man going his own way, like, is probably a little bit older, probably been married before, like, probably has those experiences, because otherwise it wouldn't inform his worldview. And so, yes, I think you're right when you say, like, it's hard to take that language seriously because, yeah, it seems like a bunch of teenagers or young people, like, being
immature
and dumb. Being immature, yeah, that's a great word for it. But then, yeah, it kind of, like, is a little insidious and spreads.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that you talked about in your paper about particularly pickup artists is because, I mean, they have this kind of low cohesion, as you talked about in your typology, because if it's a big part of the movement is people trying to sell these pickup artist tactics to other men. So maybe it didn't come across as very political because it just seemed like a marketing scheme from guys who are trying to make some money from insecure men who don't know how to pick up women.
Yeah, I think that's true as well. All of these pickup artists have different strategies, which they call game after the book. So there's like day game and night game, which you obviously use during the day and during the night. Then there's like street game, like how do you pick up women on the street? There's club game, like if you go to a nightclub. And yeah, they all have their own like version that, yeah, they're trying to sell other people to like be better pickup artists. And so, yeah, it just seems kind of not like a multi-level marketing scheme, but just a marketing scheme, I think, a lot of the time. And they also write books. That's the other thing. It's a whole series of books written, like, and the titles are stuff like Bang Latvia, right? Like how to pick up women in Latvia, or Don't Bang Sweden, like don't pick up Swedish women because, yeah, for various reasons. And so, yeah, you can buy these off, you know, they're self-published off like Amazon. But yeah, I think that's also why it potentially wasn't seen as political.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT-FM. I'm Christina Leffring, and I'm talking with Mariel Barnes about her research into the manosphere. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 608-256-2001. So we talked a little bit about how this topic has been overlooked in some ways by particularly political science as a discipline. What made you realize that this was a topic worthy of study, particularly under political science?
So like I said, I just kind of fell into this topic originally. I kind of noticed this was going on, and then I did a term paper for a course when I was a PhD student, and then it kind of was spun off into its own research agenda. One of the ways I think I recognized that it was important was there started to be a lot of similarities to between the manosphere and like public discourse that happened, and listening to people talk and hearing things from the manosphere like repeated back to me, or like not to me directly but just in society, I was like, oh, that sounds like a manosphere idea, that sounds like it comes from there. This must be kind of spreading or like kind of leaking out of what is this fringe movement into the mainstream. And I think that happened gradually, but has kind of accelerated potentially in the last, you know, 8 years, really. And so much so that a lot of the times, like these, or the majority of the time, these people are anonymous when they're in the manosphere. Or they're using a pseudonym. They're not using their real name. And it seems like that has gone away a lot of the time as people have become more comfortable and these ideas have gone mainstream. Like, you don't, a lot of people in this movement were afraid of being canceled when they were writing these blogs. They say it in the blog, like, I can't express these views anywhere else but here because I will be fired from my job. And people nowadays are not afraid of that, I don't think.
I mean, there's a whole manosphere influencer culture that has sprung up, particularly on YouTube and social media. So, yeah, there's prominent men who are attaching their names and their livelihoods to some of these ideas.
Yeah, like everyone knows Andrew Tate's name right now, whereas I can name several people from like the early manosphere who I bet people would not know about. They were prominent in the manosphere, but not outside. And so, you know, it's people like Andrew Tate, Jordan Peterson is tangential to this movement too. And then like you see people kind of sane washing these ideas a little bit. So like I see a lot of manosphere ideas come up on Joe Rogan, right? But it's never the like worst version of the idea. It's the kind of, yeah, like sane washed version. And people kind of fall or not fall for it, but like it seems reasonable to people. And then once they start believing it, they can kind of like fall down this rabbit hole.
Can you give like a specific example, maybe something you heard on Joe Rogan that like the way it was presented on Joe Rogan, it sounds reasonable, but then when you dig into it, there's just a lot more there that maybe people don't realize at first?
I mean, I'm trying to think of a specific example. It's been a while since I listened to his podcast. But like having Jordan Peterson coming on, right, and his advocacy of kind of that there are of complementarianism between men and women, I think is a classic one, in that men and women should have very distinct roles in society, and it is important to inhabit those roles so you can be a fulfilled person, I think, is one of the ones that like strikes me as something that has come from the manosphere. And like oftentimes we think it's very reasonable, like, you know, people should decide what is best for them, right? As good feminists, we should support women, and if they choose to stay at home, we should be supportive of that. But there's a more extreme version of that, which is, yeah, you definitely should never work, or like you shouldn't have the choice, or if you do choose, then you are going to be an unfulfilled person, and the only thing that can fulfill you is kind of motherhood.
Yeah, it also like reinforces a strict gender binary, which gets into a whole bunch of other issues about trans rights and recognition of even of just gender queerness and fluidity and that whole area.
Yes, absolutely. And that's completely, that's completely ignored by the manosphere. The manosphere overwhelmingly is heterosexual and very cis.
Yeah. I mean, one other thing that you talked about was that there's been this evidence that the manosphere can be a gateway to other hate groups. You mentioned particularly the alt-right, but can you give some examples about where you're seeing this kind of evolution of these ideas from the manosphere getting picked up in these extremist organizations?
Yeah, so those older manosphere or prominent manosphere figures that I mentioned knowing about before, if you look at them now, what you see is a lot of them have broadened their, say, hatred. So it's no longer just women. It's also Black people, and it's also Jews, and it's also LGBTQ folks. And so that, like, triggered this kind of thought for me that, like, the manosphere is potentially this kind of almost gateway ideology to more hateful ideologies. I think it is very easy in modern society, it's always been very easy in modern society to be slightly misogynistic. So you see this with, like, you know, locker room talk or like sexist jokes and things like that. And hating women is never, or like disliking women, let's say, is not something that is uncommon. And so once you dislike women who are, you know, 50%, 51% of the population, it's also then slight, and you think that women are responsible for your hardships in life, it's then also easier to start believing that other groups are also kind of responsible for your misery, right? So if affirmative action for women is bad, then affirmative action for African Americans is probably also harming you as a straight white male. And so then it becomes kind of, you start venturing into, you know, racist, white supremacist kind of thinking. And then it might be easier to believe in kind of anti-Semitism and anti-LGBTQ sentiments as well. And so there's kind of, I think there's this, again, it's because these people are anonymous, it's hard to track them over time and hard to track the evolution of their ideas. But from the prominent people that I know, yes, there has been this kind of slide towards not just misogyny, but other hateful ideologies and right-wing populism as well, and kind of the rise of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I have a question here from our producer, and she was asking, is there an element of conspiratorial thinking within these groups? I mean, could we see connections between the Manosphere and groups like QAnon?
I think definitely. This is not my form of research, so please don't quote me on this, but I think once you believe in kind of one conspiracy, it is easier to believe in other conspiracies. And so once you think that like women are problematic and are like kind of out to get you, then like I said, yeah, it's easier to believe that other groups, right? And then I think that kind of morphs into this extreme conspiracy thinking, you know, of QAnon and it's very extreme, like lizard people controlling the government and stuff like that. I don't think everyone slides quite that far, but I think it becomes easier to believe that other people other than yourself are responsible for your lack of success in life. So yeah, conspiratorial thinking, I think, is important in these groups, or these groups are more likely to think in those kinds of ways.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT-FM. I'm Christina Leffring from Tone Madison, and I'm talking with Mariel Barnes about her research into the Manosphere. If you want to join our conversation, we've got about 10 to 12 minutes left where you could join us. Give us a call at 608-256-2001. That's 608-256-2001. One thing that I thought was kind of interesting about your research was that you used research assistants who, I mean, I'm assuming that most of them were very, very young when a lot of this Manosphere content was published. What was it like for them to read that content? And I mean, did they see the parallels with this misogyny today?
Yeah, so we went through two different rounds of data collection. The first, I did it all myself. And then the second, we had, like you said, a bunch of research assistants, and they were undergraduates who helped us. And so we were collecting data for every organization that we identified for every year that they were in existence. So they read a lot of this content and a lot of these websites. Some of these websites are thousands of pages long, right? Like in terms of blog posts. So yeah, they read a lot of it. And it's kind of dark content at times. So we were meeting when we were collecting the data, we're meeting weekly to kind of discuss what they were reading, how they felt about it. If there were any challenges that they were encountering, if they felt it was too confronting. And for the most part, all of my undergraduates or my undergraduate RAs thought it was completely ridiculous. Like they would read these things and they would say, this is so wrong, it's laughable. And we started this trend of bringing the most outrageous thing you've read all week to our meeting, right? And then I would have them read them out, and then we would all have a bit of a laugh about it. So for the most part, they were okay with reading this stuff.
Can you give an example of like a most ridiculous thing that they brought to share?
This was 5 years ago now, so not off the top of my head. Having read some of the stuff myself, like there's a couple of websites that are written in this kind of very esoteric manner that they're trying to seem very smart. And you get to the end of this blog post, which is probably, it's probably taken them a long time to write it. It's, you know, 5,000 words. It's an essay length. And I would get to the end of it when I was reading these things and I was like, I don't know what they said. Like, I don't, it's not even that I didn't understand. Like, I understand the words on the page, but it was just kind of very, words that were trying to be very highbrow and very kind of smart, but didn't say anything at all. And that's coming from an academic who, academics can be very esoteric and highbrow and like ivory tower-ish. And so, yeah, when I read that kind of stuff and I'm like, I just spent 10 minutes of my life reading this and I've got no idea what they mean. Yeah, that kind of thing is something that sticks out in terms of, yeah, a laughable one. It's been a long time since I was talking with my RAs, so I can't really remember.
Okay. Well, we have Pat on the line here with a question. Pat, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. My question is, has the Fathers' Rights groups, have they kind of cleaned up their act? Because I had real similar stories to what you're describing in the Manosphere with my divorce, which was about 25, 30 years ago. And I can describe those experiences if you want, but they called women feminazis if they resisted their... you know, what they insisted on, no child support. My ex-husband told my son that women were abusive to men and they emotionally abusive and therefore they deserved to be physically abused. And this is an example of one of the things that wasn't said publicly, but it was said privately. I just have so bad feelings about this group that was in Madison. They'll call them Wisconsin Fathers for Children and Families, which is another public presentation of them that didn't hold up in private. Have they cleaned up their act, is my question.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think so, Pat. I think a lot of time fathers' rights groups still believe that a father's right to their children is paramount, regardless of the safety or danger that puts the children in and puts their former partner or wife in. One thing, this is not my research in particular, but I know research has been done on it, is how father's rights groups kind of mainstreamed their ideas and how they took strategies and language from the women's movement to actually make it more successful. So, you know, no one is ever against, you know, you say human rights, no one's ever like, I don't think humans shouldn't have rights. And so by calling it like father's rights, it's very hard for people to come out and say like, actually, no, fathers don't deserve any rights. And so they've been very good at like co-opting those kinds of strategies while still being like incredibly misogynistic. So you'll see in the Manosphere, these groups will want access to their children, but will not pay child support because they were baby trapped by women. And so they want access, but they don't want to support the children. And it's really just kind of a power play and a control issue rather than anything. And it's I don't want to let my partner kind of win, if that, like, that's the mentality, right? It's like winning or losing. And I want to make my former partner's life as difficult as possible. So I'm not sure I would say they've cleaned up their act. I think they've just gotten smarter about how they do it.
How does the fathers' rights movement, has that played out in the political sphere? Like, are you seeing these ideas that they have about how to change policy or the court system? Are you seeing that being picked up by mainstream right-wing politics?
I'm not sure about right wing mainstream politics, I think the fathers' rights movement has been very successful at saying that fathers should have equal access to their children. And a lot of the time, right, in probably 90% of cases, that's true. Like, you want children to grow up with both of their parents, you know, having access to both of their parents. But in a small percentage of cases, that's really not the appropriate situation because of violence or harassment or aggression. And for a long time, it was kind of just assumed, well, fathers should get those kinds of rights. And we should just, you know, regardless of the situation, children should have some access to their father. But in actuality, I think what is emerging now is questioning kind of that and what is actually thinking about what is actually best for kids and what is the context in which kind of this partnership is breaking up. Is there violence involved? Is that violent, like, is that violence directed towards children, or are the children witnessing it? Because we know that witnessing that kind of violence and abuse has long-term impacts on children. And so I think fathers' rights were very successful, and now there's starting to be a little bit of pushback and being like, we should examine this a little bit more closely.
Yeah, we're running low on time, but I wanted to just ask about something that I think we've been touching upon but haven't really talked about. I mean, the Netflix miniseries Adolescence dramatized the way that exposure to these ideas can shape young men's thinking about relationships and women. And there's been a lot of back and forth online about that. I guess like Pat was talking about her ex-partner sharing these ideas with her son. I mean, do we know how these ideas being exposed to young boys shapes the way that they think about these things?
As far as I know, there hasn't been a formal study looking at that. I think undoubtedly it does, right? We see that with violent pornography, right? I think the average age of exposure now to pornography is 7 or 8 years old. And it teaches young boys that sex and pleasure should be done in a particular way, which is often very far removed from reality. So I think we can also, I think there's probably a similar thing going on with exposure to the manosphere and ideas about like how you treat women. I also think like this is another way that technology plays a role here in that it's very easy to be exposed to these ideas. So like social media and like YouTube and stuff are designed to keep eyeballs on their platform at all times. And so the way you do that is you feed people extreme content so they don't want to click off and look away. And so, you know, there's been research, again, not mine, but others, where you upload a clean profile and it's like, how many clicks does it take before you start getting that extreme content? And it's not very many clicks at all. And then all of a sudden, the algorithm is feeding you this kind of more extreme media that you just keep watching. And, you know, when you're being flooded with this information, like it can be easy to alter your perception of like what is actually the world and what is kind of the truth. And so, yeah, I think exposure happens early and then it can have like kind of extremely negative consequences. Not always murder, as the case was in Adolescence, but just like poor treatment of women and girls.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Mariel Barnes is an assistant professor of public affairs at the La Follette School of Public Affairs, where she researches everyday forms of violence against women, gender, and the relationship between gender and institutions. She is also a core faculty member of UW-Madison's Sexual Violence Research Initiative, an interdisciplinary group designed to investigate the psychological, societal, and policy aspects of sexual violence. Her paper titled The Manosphere and Politics was published in the first volume of Comparative Political Science of 2025. Mariel Barnes, thank you so much for joining me on A Public Affair.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you to producer Sarah Gabler. Our engineer today is John, and our receptionist is Steve. Stick around this afternoon for Letters in Politics. That's coming up right after the BBC here on Community Radio WORT Madison. I'm Christina Leffring. Thanks for joining us. Supported live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with an admission that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media, distorted. We come and listen and supported live and direct.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
over the last 30, 40 years, I've come to recognize another nature hidden within every trade war, and that is a class war, a hidden class war wrapped up in a trade war. Because one of the great fallacies of our era, and when I say our era, I mean the last 200 years, is to imagine that this is, you know, something like a war between the United States and China, between America and Europe, and so on. It never is. There is a much more interesting story to be told there, along the lines of a class war.
We're joined by former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, for a conversation about the so-called trade war. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. The medical charity MSF says children fleeing the violence in Sudan's Darfur region are dying of thirst. Many of the thousands who walked to the town of Tawila from the Zamzam refugee camp following its capture by the paramilitaries were completing the journey in a state of severe dehydration. Michiel Hoffman is from the MSF.
We are working just 60 kilometers north of Zamzam in Tawila. So far, 24,000 people from Zamzam have arrived there, and they arrive in terrible condition. Children severely dehydrated, a lot of malnourished.